And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have actually three interviews for you today, a brand new author interview, a conversation with Dr. James Ripley talking about a very special celebratory band concert coming up at Carthage College Saturday night, rounding out this 150th anniversary season for the Kenosha Wind Orchestra. And we have another special surprise that I'll tell you about a little later. Here's part one. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about an incredibly important book, a book really intended for young readers, and yet I am not ashamed to say that I learned a tremendous amount from reading this book called Made in Asian America, A History for Young People. This is a book that seeks to, in a sense, set the record straight, to fill in many of the gaps in our collective education when it comes to the presence of Asians in America and the contributions that they have made to our life and the kind of terrible racism which they have faced over the course of many, many decades. It is a story most of us who are in a sense white Americans, if you will, know very, very little about. I know that I find myself shamefully unaware of so many details about the history of Asian Americans. So I am grateful to have had the chance to read this book published by Quill Tree Books. The two women responsible for it are Erica Lee, who is a historian, author, and teaches at Harvard University and has written a number of books, including The Making of Asian America and America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. The other author, Christina Suntornvat, is someone who is a three-time Newbery Honor recipient. Her works include All 13, The Incredible Cave Rescue of the Thai Boys Soccer Team. And she has actually over 20 books she has written for young readers. This one, again, titled Made in Asian America, A History for Young People. Erica Lee and Christina Suntornvat, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to have you. Good to be here.
I am so grateful that this book has been written and is available. I think it is incredibly important. And as I said at the outset, even though you intended it for young readers, it is something that I think a whole lot of people, even if you're 63 years old like I am, should be reading and would learn a lot from. Tell us about the challenge of telling this story so completely and yet with the intention of it being a book to connect with young readers. What kind of a challenge was that for the two of you?
Greg, this is Erica, and I'll start and then let Christina fill in some of the gaps. But thank you again so much for reading the book and for your review. I think that we couldn't have asked for a better review. It's certainly a history for young people, but I know, like you, there are many, many adults who are interested in this history as well and who are waiting for a book like this, not just for their own kids and their students, but honestly for themselves. But yes, you're right. It was an incredible challenge to write a book about Asian American history. We cover 400 years, and Asian Americans are an extremely diverse population. Fastest growing group in the United States, make up 7% of the current population, but represent folks from all across East and South and Southeast Asia with roots back to those countries, and really diverse stories. So that was one of the biggest challenges, is what threads to pull out of those histories to share with all of our readers, young and slightly older. And so I think we've done a good job talking about American history through the lens of Asian Americans. You touched on some of those themes already, racism, xenophobia, but it's also a story of migration and taking chances and pushing for and securing equal rights not only for Asian Americans, but for all Americans.
So this is Christina. I'll just add that we knew from the outset that making history relevant and interesting for kids was going to be a big challenge for us. And we knew that we could easily overwhelm them with dates and events and lists and timelines. And so the way that we decided to tell this history was through the stories of real people. And wherever we could, we chose to highlight real teens, real young people, kids and teenagers, and tell the events in history through their eyes. So that's how the book is structured, is through personal narratives. You get to know these people who are kids just like kids living today. And I think that's going to be an effective way to reach our readers.
The book is incredibly timely as well. And of course, it is being published and released at a time when the whole issue of immigration and the immigrants among us is in the headlines all the time, and often in really disturbing fashion. Did you write intentionally and structure the book intentionally to make it timely, or is it just on its own a very timely book for the times in which we find ourselves right now?
This is Erica again, and I'll start with an answer and then let Christina follow up if she wishes. It's a great question, and you're absolutely right that we Americans are reading news about immigration every day, and again, sometimes in really disturbing ways. And in many ways, of course, the book is timely and does seek to shed some light on the history and current conditions of immigrants, whether they be of Asian descent or not. But in other ways, it's a timeless story because this is a history, and American history is one of immigration and also migration. And so we hope that readers will get a sense of some of the past conflicts that the United States has engaged in over immigration, but also the resilience of immigrants and their descendants. Christina and I are both descendants of immigrants, and so these are personal stories. In fact, some of our family histories are part of this book. And we hope that we can humanize the story of immigration for all readers in a way that adds some empathy and humanity back into some of the disturbing headlines.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important things of why we need to know history, is to notice patterns and notice trends that are coming up and popping up again. I remember several years ago seeing the Japanese Americans whose families have been incarcerated during World War II showing up to protest about the detention of immigrants and the separation of immigrant families at the border. And they held signs that said, never again, because they didn't want to see what had happened to their own families here decades later happening yet again. And the vilification of immigrants, whether they're Asian American or, you know, any immigrant at all. So I think that this is the power of learning history, is taking action when you see something happening that's happened before.
At one point in the book, you take a few moments to talk about the term Oriental. And I am old enough to remember a time when that term was used very freely with, in a sense, clear conscience. And of course, now that term, we understand its, in a sense, its implications so much better than we once did. Explain why, even for young readers, you think it's important to take a moment to talk about this particular words and other issues related to language.
That's a wonderful question, and this is Erica. My parents, second-generation Chinese-Americans, grew up being known only as Orientals. And so it really is within our lifetime that term and label has been used. And I think in many parts of the country, it is still used rather than Asian American. And one of the wonderful chapters in our book describes just how that the term Asian American came to be. And it was part of the 1960s social protest movement when peoples of Asian descent, Americans of Asian descent, were getting tired of being called by a term that they had not chosen and a term that was used in really derogatory ways. And for them, it was really important to not be seen as Oriental, as something from someone from the Orient, a distant and exotic but kind of uncivilized, barbaric land, which is the ways in which that term was used throughout the 19th and early 20th century, but rather in a way that rooted them in the United States as Americans, but of Asian descent. And so in the 1960s, there became a term to self-name themselves as Asian Americans, Americans of Asian descent.
I really appreciate the fact that your book takes such a long view. I mean, going all the way back to the era of slavery and pointing out the far more significant place of Asian slaves on the North American continent than I think most of us ever realize. And, of course, trace much of the history, including points of time when the discrimination was sort of rampant across the board. And at other times when we were more, in a sense, selective with our bigotry, for instance, during the Second World War, when it was okay to befriend the Chinese, but the Japanese, of course, Japanese Americans were viewed with grave suspicion. And so the way in which this bigotry is played out over our country's history is also something that you probe with a lot of detail, and I appreciate that. I want to just give each of you a chance to pick out one of the people that you focus on in the book. I mean, stories of resilient, gifted, young Asian Americans. I'll give each of you a chance to kind of choose one to give our listeners a sense of what this book is about.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, I'll go first. One of my favorite people that we profiled was the Olympian Sunisa Lee. So if you remember, just very recently in the 2020 Olympics, she won the gymnastics women's all-around gold medal. And that was an incredible event, historic event. She was also the first Hmong Olympian ever. And you know, her story is incredible for so many reasons, but I just remember watching the Olympics before even knowing I was going to work on this book, and seeing her huge Hmong family watching and cheering along in a room filled with people, and, you know, reading about, you know, listening to interviews with her talk about how much pride she felt, also pressure that she felt as, you know, someone who's carrying a lot of the hopes and dreams of people who came to the United States mostly as refugees after the wars in Southeast Asia. So her story is an example of how we lead into talking about the United States' role in those wars in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, and the lasting impact that it's had on the people in that region, and then the people who came to the United States and began shaping the, you know, United States in their ways, including being these Olympic heroes like Suni Lee.
Very good.
And this is Erica, and the young people that are inspiring this book are a group of middle school and high school students who I interviewed in 2021 who were making headlines. They were protesting and advocating for the inclusion of Asian American history and studies in their classrooms in New Jersey. And I called them up and talked with them each and learned their stories and learned how they felt that they were forced to learn Asian American history and a lot of other parts of American history on their own. It wasn't in their classrooms, wasn't in their library books. And during the pandemic, they were harassed and verbally abused and felt that one of the answers to fight anti-Asian racism and racism in general was more education, and in particular, more education about Asian Americans. So they lobbied in the state of New Jersey. They joined with other students across the country that include Asian American history as a graduation requirement.
Great stories. Those are just two of many wonderful stories in this fascinating, illuminating book titled Made in Asian America, A History for Young People, published by Quill Tree Books. It includes fascinating rare photographs. The co-authors, Erica Lee and Christina Suntonvat, thank you so much for giving the world this really important book. I hope many people will take the opportunity to explore it and learn from it. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. Best wishes.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of three on today's program is a conversation with Dr. Jim Ripley, a faculty colleague of mine from the music department at Carthage, director of instrumental activities there, and very, very busy with a concert that is coming up on Saturday night, one of a number of big events coming up at Carthage, including a percussion ensemble concert Wednesday night, the spring choral concert on Friday night, and then Saturday night, a very special celebratory concert that brings to a close what has been a banner year for the college's band program, celebrating 150 years of band music at Carthage. And we're going to be talking about Saturday night's gala concert, which is at 7:30 in Siebert Chapel. Dr. James Ripley, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's wonderful to be here, and it's a beautiful day today. So,
absolutely. And, of course, it's been a big, beautiful, busy year for you and for the bands at Carthage celebrating this 150th anniversary year with all kinds of different events scattered throughout the year. And here's where it all culminates, right?
It is really amazing for me to think back at all of the things that have happened over the year and that we're just a week out, not even a week out from now being done with everything. Whether it was in Japan with the ensemble or having the alumni back for homecoming, the recreation concert, recreation. For those of you that don't know about that, we did a concert based on the very first program at the college when it was in Illinois. And then also we had a guest conductor for our band festival that was a wonderful alum who treated a lot of students around the area to what it was like to be a student at Carthage back in the 70s.
Yeah. So, yeah, I love the fact that this big anniversary was celebrated in lots of different ways, and it made the year full of variety and yet with this beautiful, cohesive through line. And, of course, as we said, it all culminates in Saturday night's concert, which includes something extra special. And I know that you really wanted to kind of time this in a really special way, and that is a piece that has been commissioned to celebrate this banner year for the Carthage Band. So explain the person whom you know very, very well who has been commissioned to create a new piece.
Well, Timothy Marr is our composer, and for 29 years, Tim was the band director at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and did his doctorate in composition at the University of Iowa, which is actually where he met his wife. Kathy knows Tim more than, or before I even got to know him. And we've been dear friends for many years. The sense of having him write a piece for the band is something that I'd looked at for a number of years and a number of occasions, but this was really the one that seemed to point out that this was that kind of work that he would really do a wonderful job with. His connectedness to taking musical ideas and developing them is really wonderful. He describes it as organic composition, but he starts with very simple motives and then develops them into all sorts of wonderful new sections of music based upon specific things. In this case, he's really fond of turning around numbers or sometimes the letters of certain kinds of institutions that might be commissioning him. Maybe a St. Olaf College would be SCC or something like that. So it would be like an E flat and then two Cs or something like that is what he specializes in. So for our program, he worked off of the rehearsal room band number. It's 142.
That's where, that's the band room where the band rehearses most of the time.
It is. And so what he constructed was the first, the fourth, and the second tones of a scale, one, and then four, and then two. So you've got one, four, two.
Right.
Yeah.
So, do, fa, re. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's how he starts the piece, and it develops into a scene where, it, very much like a cinematic experience, you're going along with all of these different kinds of characters that enter the room and experience different kinds of forces of, I wouldn't say good and evil, but it's certainly different kinds of experiences that they have, which are challenging and then ultimately result in a positive conclusion, which shows the fortitude. And so just one other quick thing about the numbers and the title. We played around with 142 and 142 and 142, which became fortitude.
Ah.
And so the title of scene one, fortitude, is the same thing as if you were walking down the ramp into the band room and you seen 142. So there's a little bit of a backstory pun to the whole title, but it's really about fortitude.
That's great. I love that. I want to pose a question to you that I know Liz Snyder from the Kenosha News and Racine Journal Times posed to you, and it's a great, great question. As a matter of fact, I've asked it of others before, but in this case, I think it's just a really good question.
Yeah.
And the question is, when you commission a piece, do you have some say in its development, in what it ends up being, or do you essentially take it as it is once the composer is done with it? And let's talk especially about, in this case, this piece called Scene 1, Fortitude by Timothy Marr.
Yeah, in this case, we've been involved together from the outset and throughout the process. We've been looking at this for over 2 years, and so the initial idea, but especially what's been wonderful lately is Tim came out in the first part of the month and did what we would call a workshop with the band, where we had a chance to play for him, and then we actually were making adjustments based upon what was needed. There were certain chords that he'd actually written more notes than what we had players to perform. So
wow.
Something like that, to also things like balance issues, where there were certain things that seemed to work fine in his mind and on the computer, but didn't necessarily work with what we had to do. So sometimes that's a change in how loud certain sections play so that something can be heard. Sometimes it's adding extra voices. Sometimes it's taking them out. So that was a real nuts and bolts session. And even last night, Tim sent me another set of things that he would like to see based upon a rehearsal recording that I sent him on Friday. So we're still tweaking things even as it goes.
Wow.
And to those same things, just saying if this can be beefed up a little bit, you know, add in a few more voices or whatever, just so that it can come to the real idea that he has in his mind for the piece. It's a pretty difficult piece, and it's got lots of unique things for the students to do that aren't a part of our regular kinds of playing.
Well, it sounds like you're very excited about it, and I suspect the students are as well.
Yes, definitely. The opening is just extraordinary, and it's something that every time we start the piece, you can just see the students light up about how it works. But also, as they've come to really dig into the music, they're finding even a greater appreciation as they work through it longer.
Very good. Yeah. So this commission piece, Scene 1, Fortitude by Timothy Marr, will have its world premiere Saturday night at this special concert that brings to a close this 150th anniversary year of the bands at Carthage College. There is other music that's on the program, and you were telling me that each and every piece that is on this highly varied program is there for a reason.
Absolutely. This has been a year of planning, but towards this final concert in particular, and we wanted to be able to both look backward as well as look forward with the programming. I guess the thing that I'll start out with is actually the ending. We're doing a piece called Amen, and that was just simply because of the title that we want to just conclude this year with just a final resounding Amen. But what's unique about the piece, actually a couple of things, is that it has a surprise that I won't even tell you about now. If people come to the concert, they'll understand what I'm talking about with that. But what I would say is that it actually ends quietly. That after all of this time and exploring the background as well as the future, we're looking to the future and just to say it's not over. This doesn't actually, you know, end with a big bang at all. And that was intentional.
Life goes on.
Exactly, exactly. But we open with a connection to the full year. Our first piece that we played was based on the Luther hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. And this concert also begins with the similar tune, but now in a setting by Jim Kernow. We will also be doing another piece in our Black Composers Matter initiative by Ulysses Kay, who was a wonderful composer in the 50s and 60s. A prologue and parade is what it's called. It's kind of a parody of a march, which is a fun piece for us all to play. There's also a selection by Ray Vaughan Williams, the Folk Song Suite, which is his at Carthage, the most frequently played piece over the years was the English Folk Song Suite. And so we'll be returning to that.
So the Carthage bands, of all that they've played over these 150 years, this Folk Song Suite by Vaughan Williams is the number one in terms of frequency.
It is. It is.
So it's a great piece.
And we will also be looking at the year 1873 one more time with Home on the Range, this lovely Western folk song that was written in 1873. We have a setting by Jim Barnes, who is the composer that we've used on our silent movies before as the accompaniment. So we're tying some of that together as well.
Wonderful.
And we have a piece that was written for our Amati ensemble, the chamber winds. So we have selections by the concert band, something from Amati, something for the wind orchestra. And we also tied into the history of the college with the brass choir for so many years. Bill Roth was able to take the brass choir with his wonderful organ playing around the country and around the world, actually. And so we are paying homage to that tradition with a brass chorale by Samuel Barber that was written for the National Cathedral when they opened up their carillon bell tower. Barber wrote this chorale for Ascension Day, and since it's Ascension Day weekend, we'll be doing that as well.
Fantastic. What a great lineup of all kinds of wonderful music at a really busy time in the semester, of course, for the students with finals right around the corner. So this is not the easiest time to present a concert, and yet I'm sure you're riding the winds of all kinds of special anniversary energy, if you will.
Yes, they're very focused on bringing this last concert to life. We've had a wonderful year. Sometimes, you know, you'll hit some dry spells with students, but this has not been the case. All year long, they've really, really been wonderful to work with. And it has been very busy, as well as just finishing up the musical and having students involved with that as well.
So Saturday night's concert, the final concert of the Carthage Bands in this 150th anniversary year. Again, we'll include the world premiere of this commission piece by Timothy Marr, Scene 1, Fortitude, and this whole array of other pieces as well. So Saturday night's concert is at 7:30 p.m. in Siebert Chapel. Do people have to buy tickets in order to attend?
No, this will be open and free for all. So we please invite everyone to come and celebrate with us. I don't think there's going to be any cake afterwards, but but we'll certainly have a festive evening planned for everyone that it comes.
Excellent. We hope people will mark their calendars and plan accordingly. And we do want to make mention as well of the Spring Choral Concert at Carthage, which is Friday night.
Yes.
And then the Percussion Ensemble Concert, which actually comes up on Wednesday night. And whenever I'm able to attend, I always love what the Percussion Ensemble does. That's so exciting in and of its own right. So lots of great musical events to be taking in over the next few days at Carthage College. And Dr. James Ripley, it's been a really fun anniversary year. I'm glad we've had the opportunity to hear about so much of what's been going on from you. And we hope that year 151 is going to be just as fun, if not quite so stressful. Do you look forward to a so-called normal year coming up?
I do. I'm looking for things to play that don't have to do with 1873, but more so the Wind Orchestra will be on tour in the fall. We're going to be doing some wonderful things, including a Star Wars concert next year, and so the future looks bright.
Very good. Dr. James Ripley, thank you for being my morning show guest today here on WGTD.
Thank you, Greg.
Part 3 coming up in just a moment. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This past Saturday night was an exciting evening in Madison. The annual event of the WBA, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. And at Saturday night's event, WGTD was awarded a number of different events, different awards. We were given a third-place award of excellence for our Gateway Radio Reading Service, for Medium Market Music Radio, for Best Significant Community Impact. The WGTD Midday News with News Director Dave McGrath received second place in Medium Market Music Radio for Best Newscast. We also had our radio theater program under the direction of Dr. Stephen Brown take away a couple of different first-place honors for their 2023 holiday show and the Kane Shadow, the library mystery. And I'm very happy and humbled to say that I was given first place in this medium market for best interview. And the interview that took first place is the interview that I'm about to replay, an interview that I was privileged to record with actor William Shatner. And for a lifetime fan of Star Trek, it was a dream come true, a great, great thrill, and of course, doubly thrilling to have it recognized in this way. So here is the interview as we entered it in this competition for the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have something very exciting planned for part one of today's morning show. And here is some music by composer James Horner to help set the stage. That music is the magnificent main theme to Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan, music of James Horner, with a brief quotation of the iconic theme from the original series, music of Alexander Courage. Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan is going to be screened this Friday evening at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee. And on hand for that special occasion will be none other than William Shatner himself, famous the world over for his portrayal of Captain James T. Kirk, not only in the original television series, but in seven theatrical films that followed. William Shatner's career, of course, has extended well beyond the world of Star Trek to include the series T.J. Hooker, The Practice, Boston Legal, Better Late Than Never, and Rescue 911. And he has a one-man show that has sold out all across the country. And William Shatner comes to Milwaukee to answer fan questions about this and the other Star Trek films and about his experience of portraying the iconic role of James T. Kirk. I recorded an interview with William Shatner earlier this morning and asked him what's going to happen at Friday night's screening.
I don't know how unusual what I'm doing, what I will be doing, that perhaps is. I mean, I don't know. I don't follow it, so as far as I'm concerned, I'm the only one doing it. Showing a movie that was very popular, and it's been refurbished, The Wrath of Khan, color and sound and all that kind of thing. And then I'll come out after the movie is over and talk about anything they want to talk about, the audience wants to talk about, whether it's about the movie and how we made it, what we did, other things that are of interest, and spend an hour to an hour and a half with the audience, having fun with the audience. It's very unusual. It's a great evening in the theater. And strangely, and you'll have to help me solve this, Greg, is I'm going to four cities that weekend, this coming weekend. I will be in Atlanta, in Indianapolis, in Detroit, and Milwaukee. Everywhere else is just about sold out. Very few tickets left. Somehow, in Milwaukee, we've got tickets available, and we don't know why tickets are slow to go in Milwaukee. Uniquely, it's a wonderful show, so I urge your listening audience to come to the theater on Friday night. It's going to be great fun.
No doubt, and I have a feeling that what you just described is not going to be true much longer. I want to ask you, first of all, how different was it making the films, that is, those six original series motion pictures, versus making the television series itself many years ago? Of course, it was a completely different schedule, and lots of other things were different. How different did it feel to you and your fellow actors?
Well, making a movie is lethargic by comparison to doing television. Television, you have to do 10 pages a day of dialogue. So there's an awful lot of words that have to be learned and be said. Movies are made in setups. Camera moves in a direction, takes a picture of you, may then cut. You move the camera back. It's a wide shot. It's a two shot. It's a three shot. Time is taken to get a variety of shots, but not on television, because moving that camera around takes time, and time is limited because you've got to get those 10 pages in, whereas in a movie, you might just get the one shot, and that's it, folks. Let's wrap. We'll come meet tomorrow. So the pace of a movie and the pace of a television show is extravagantly different.
Which was more fun for you, maybe, and maybe I should ask two questions. Which was more fun? Which was more satisfying to you as an actor, making the series or making these motion pictures? Or is it difficult to judge?
The same thing applies. For me, the same thing applies. You might be able to do a take. I was on a stage where the actress had to say no. She was in close-up. And they did it 30 times. Now, I can't explain to you why the first no wasn't satisfactory to the director, as was the 30th no became either satisfactory or he gave up. But you don't have that kind of time in television. Say no, no, okay, wrap, let's go. There's more time to fashion your performance. So if it takes 30 no's to get the no, then you take that time according, you know, if that's what satisfies the director. Whereas in television, just get the word out. Say no, good, wrap, let's go. and that's not an exaggeration.
Wow.
So, but there's an excitement to it. That kind of speed, you've got to be up to speed. So you've got to rehearse yourself, and you've got to be there. And so the adrenaline is flowing. So you might get something else, something better, something different than pondering, how am I going to say no today?
Right. And, of course, you know, one of the great wonders of that original series is that on that tight schedule and with an increasingly tight budget, the best episodes of that series are some of the best television ever made and, of course, endure to this very day. It's a show I've loved for 50 years now.
Thank you for saying that. And you're absolutely right. The stories that the reason that the Wrath of Khan has survived all these years, in my opinion, is it tells a beautiful story. It's an emotional, evocative story. And that was the best of Star Trek. And no matter how little our budgets were and how fast we had to move, if the writer, who is the most important part of anything, let alone on television, the story you're telling is the important part of it. And how many bad performers and bad directors survived a wonderful script because it wasn't anything they did. It was the power of the words and the power of the story.
Power of the story. Absolutely.
And vice versa, of course, it works the other way around. No matter how talented the director and actors were, if you're telling a terrible story, it's not going to work either.
Speaking of talented actors, of course, in addition to the entire original cast that was assembled, including, of course, you, Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, and all the rest, this film was also notable for the return of one Ricardo Montalban in the role of Khan. You have many exchanges with him in this terrific film. I don't remember that you were ever physically in the same room. I wonder, what was exactly your encounter with him?
Years later, I recall all these years later, somebody said that to me, and I thought, you know, you're right. It didn't occur to me that the two of us weren't on screen together because we became really good friends a little bit before that time, and making the film, and then afterwards, we had become really wonderful acquaintances. That it didn't occur to me that I didn't have a scene with him, but it was pointed out. You know, you're never on screen with him. We have exchanges, but never together at the same time.
Never. You two were never in the same room in terms of on camera, but of course, close collaborators and. There is a very special chemistry between the two of you. And, of course, spoiler alert to our listeners, one of the most notable scenes in this film is where Leonard Nimoy's character, Mr. Spock, perishes in the act of selflessly saving the ship and its crew. What was it like to perform that death scene? And at the time, did you know that that was a death that was not going to be permanent? I mean, in the moment, did you think you were saying goodbye forever to the character of Spock?
I was astonished when the producer said, we're going to kill Spock. And I said, are you crazy? You know, I ranted and raved, no, we're going to kill Spock. I didn't know. that my dear friend Leonard and the producers had concocted this idea because, and this is how clever Leonard was, he said, I'm tired of playing Spock unless I can direct Star Trek III, the next film after this one that we're showing at the theater. Unless I can direct it, I'm not going to play it anymore. And he forced the studio to allow him to direct, which then allowed me to direct one of the Star Trek films. So it was planned, and I didn't know it.
Well, it's an amazing scene, just one of many amazing scenes in this terrific movie. And I imagine you are excited about the possibility of people being able to see this once again on the big screen.
It's a delight. It's a great evening in the theater. With this refurbished film, color and sound on the big screen, and then I come out afterwards and try my best to entertain the audience. And in those hours, it's a very special evening.
No doubt. And William Shatner, thank you so much for all you've given the world, and best wishes and safe travels to Milwaukee.
Thank you so much. I look forward to being there.
That is the interview with which I was able to score first place for Middle Market Music Radio for Best Interview of the Year. My thanks to everyone here at WGTD for their help and support. Congratulations to the other award winners, both from WGTD and from radio stations all across the state of Wisconsin. Tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different interviews, including one with Martin McClendon from the theater department at Carthage, and Michael Cote, the founder of Enough, Plays to End Gun Violence. They had a hand in the creation of the latest verbatim play for the Carthage theater department, and they will be having a premiere reading of this new play this coming weekend, titled Terminal Exhale, based on interviews done with healthcare providers who have dealt with gunshot victims. On Wednesday, best-selling author Patrick O'Donnell talking about his latest book, The Unvanquished, which looks at the development of special forces during our own Civil War and examining how that took place both on the Confederate and Union side. And I look forward to Kaylin Palomares' visit to the morning show on Thursday with a representative from the Lake County Forest Preserves. We'll be talking about cicadas. And on Friday, a look back at one of the most fascinating figures in poetic history, Lord Byron. Our weather forecast calls for sunny skies today, a high of 66 degrees, easterly winds 10 miles per hour. Increasing clouds overnight with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow, showers and thunderstorms are likely with a high temperature of 71 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.